You're listening to the Ruhi Sleep, Sleep in Society podcast, recorded in Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
The Neolithic Revolution, which is a combination of many, many revolutions, took place some 10,000 years ago. We humans made micro steps from foraging to farming. It changed what we ate and how we ate. Today, joining me on Sleep in Society is my good friend, Kim Breland. Kim is a Toronto-based artist with a long career in healthcare management, focusing on mental health and homelessness. Kim will be joining me for a series on conversation with a focus on diet and nutrition component of the case study, The Role of Self-Regulation to Counter the Slow Violence of Shift Work. Kim is also one of my advisors, and I often consult with Kim in terms of use of language so it is made more accessible and not too academic to a wider public. Kim, I would like to welcome you to Sleep in Society podcast, and I would like to hand the mic over to you.
Thank you so much, Ruhi. It's a delight to be here. I've been following the podcast since the early days, and I find the topic so interesting. And of course, you know that I love to talk about food.
Yes, you have us. And I thought it was such a great idea to invite you as a guest host while I wanted to discuss the diet component of the Shift Work case study because of your love of food, among other things.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I do find nutrition fascinating. And I know that in this long study, you have learned and discovered a great many things, and that you started out, even before you began the study, being someone who was interested in food and nutrition. I've certainly had the opportunity to eat some of your lovely cooking, and I understand that you've been cooking for almost your entire life.
Almost. I think I really started cooking in my teens. But I observed very closely my mother and my grandmother, who, by the way, considering I'm coming from a patriarchy where women are, they should know how to cook, or they should know at least how the kitchens run, were kind enough to just say, no, just do the observation part of it, because cooking is such a key component in our life. And so it really helped me to see how they saw food. My mother was an urban gardener. My grandmother was like a farmer and a feminist. And watching them cook, I still have memories in terms of the food that they would cook and how they cooked. And I think I utilized all of that knowledge when I had to learn how to do it by myself once I moved to Canada on my own at a very young age.
And so it sounds like a lot of what you learned was really just through watching and observing and being with people while they did something, which is a really wonderful way to learn. Did they use a lot of fancy ingredients?
Well, India, as you know, is a country which has so many spices. It has such an incredible diversity in terms of food. But in terms of my mother's use of ingredients was usually very simple. I wouldn't say we were vegetarians, but meat wasn't like a regular thing in our daily diet. It wasn't a regular part of our daily diet. Most of our diet was vegetarian. Most of our food was fresh, and my mom was able to, you know, take the humblest of ingredients and convert them into something absolutely, absolutely delicious.
And I remember you saying that for each of those humble ingredients, she probably knew how to cook them 20 different ways.
Yes, indeed. She could do that with the zucchini, which still amazes me to no end.
Are some of the recipes that you make today still ones that you learned from your mother and grandmother?
Some of them, like if I really want to go into it. But, you know, you and I have been having this conversation now off the record for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And we talked about the idea that some of the dishes that my grandmother would make or my mother would make were part of what now we call slow food movement. Because some of the dishes that they made would take, you know, half a day or three quarters of a day to make, which in the world that we live in, that is not as much as a possibility. So if I'm making certain dishes like that, I usually give myself a day off completely just to do cooking, which is amazing to me. I really, really like that and appreciate that every once in a while I devote a day to just cooking.
That sounds like a wonderful luxury, because the act of cooking itself can be very nurturing in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Have you done that yourself, Kim, like where you have taken a day to just cook a dish, like spend a whole day cooking a dish?
Maybe not one dish. I'm the kind of person that likes to make 20 different things at once. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, especially if I'm preparing for a dinner party or a party, I like to make a lot of different things at once. And I'm the kind of person who loves leftovers, so I'm very happy to cook in large batches so that I don't have to cook again for another couple of days. That suits my lifestyle, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think like it's the same thing with like Indian cooking too. It's not going to be a dish, but there is going to be a dish within the five that you're cooking that is going to take half a day, because the way that you are creating the foundation of it is like a very slow process. Like you're cooking it over a very slow, low heat. So that's pretty amazing, and you're layering it up and you're layering it up, and the dish end up being like so beautifully layered with such complex flavors that in the end that it's such a worthwhile undertaking.
Yes, because those methods can definitely affect the flavor, and I think that that's something that in North America at least we have very much not been in the habit of. I think that people in North America have very short memories, because what we now call slow cooking is the same thing as our grandparents simply called cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that your grandparents were farmers and your mom had a kitchen garden. And for example, what we call organic farming is simply what our grandparents used to call farming. So I always thought that was funny.
Mm-hmm.
But
in terms of like the slow food movement was actually in kind of retaliation to the fast food movement.
Indeed.
And it was like started in Italy by a chef called Carlo Petrini, because they were also kind of worried about the preservation of biodiversity, and they wanted to show where the food was coming from, because I think they were worried about the idea that if, you know, fast food took over, then we would forget where the food came from and the implications that it'll have over the long term in terms of the health and well-being of people.
Yes, it's so very important, because you're right, it's not just about flavor. And I think that as the world has sped up and adopted other priorities, that these are often things that aren't necessarily part of people's lives. But for you, because you do have a very inquisitive and scientific mind, and you do like to think deeply about things and learn about things, appreciating how interrelated all these factors are has probably had a very large impact on your study, as well as the way that you live your life.
Yeah, indeed. I think when I first came to Canada, like prior to that, I don't recall, and we talked about this off the record, that I don't recall ever going to a restaurant in my, like, you know, when I was young or early teens, because I arrived in Canada in my very early teens. And the first time that I went to a restaurant was in Canada. And the first time I tasted fast food was in Canada. And it was not at all, I was not expecting it to be that particular flavor, because I was expecting, I'd been, you know, I grew up looking at the magazines of these awesome looking burgers and these amazing looking food. And I thought, oh, it's going to be fantastic in flavor. But when I remember tasting a burger for the first time, I actually got sick.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I actually got quite ill from not just tasting the flavor, but just the whole, I couldn't digest it.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah, and so it was very, and you don't, I don't, you don't have enough information, but now that I've gotten in really into the study of science and the science of diet and nutrition, I realized that probably my gut wasn't ready for it, that I did not have my biome wasn't ready to accept that kind of food, and was like, what are you eating? What is this? We're not acquainted with this. Get it out of your system. So I think
it's not quite food.
Or whatever this is not something we should be eating.
That sounds like a painful lesson.
Interesting one. Not to say that I didn't eat like fast food again, but I thought that was an interesting introduction to fast food.
Yes, absolutely. And so learning about food the way that you did, and coming from a place and a childhood where you were not exposed to restaurants, to fast food, where the cooking was very much a part of the home and the family life, you had a pretty complete existing knowledge about food and food preparation and about nutrition, even before you had a family or before you started this long study that you've been working on for years now. I'm curious what you learned that surprised you and caused you to change your mind in your eating habits as you were doing an in-depth dive into nutrition as part of your study. Was there anything that surprised you?
Oh, absolutely. Many things. But the one thing that stands out, and you know, you and I are going to go into all of those things a little in our in this particular series on diet and nutrition, it was the timing of the diet. Timing of what you eat, when you eat, totally shocked me. And that, to me, was a revelation. And it's also a recent revelation because it took me a while. I was pretty good in terms of my diet intake and my nutrition. Like, you know, I ate well, I ate organic, and I went, in terms of like organic foods, I went into organic eating the moment like I got pregnant, because I really wanted to know what I was putting in my body and what nutrition I was giving to my child. Mm-hmm. And also learning about like organic food at that particular point. Also, I learned about local farmers and introduced myself to local farmers where my food was coming from.
Oh, how lovely.
Yeah, it's amazing like how much we have. And in terms of like farmers in Kingston, as well as in Toronto too. Local farmers. But it was very interesting to me that knowing all of this, that, you know, that what I needed to eat, the diet component and nutrition component of it, that it was, you know, the eating of apple in the morning is not the same thing as eating that apple in the evening. That actually can be harmful to you. And that's most recent revelation, I have to say. And so that part of it was shocking to me, because I thought I was doing all of these things that were necessary in terms of my well-being, in terms of my nutrition, exercise, all of those things that were so important to keep at bay the negative impact that the shift work was having on me. But as I got more and more into what it meant in terms of hormones, in terms of metabolic systems, all of those things completely changed. And at times it was felt more like a slap on one's face, I have to say, because you're like, oh, if I'm eating my greens and I'm eating low amount of carbs and I'm eating proteins at a certain point of time, and then you realize actually it's all about the timing of it, that can really throw a wrench into what you think you know.
Yeah, I think this is so fascinating, and I'm very much looking forward to the episode where we go into that in more detail, because I don't think it was a revelation just for you. I think that the whole field of chrononutrition
mm-hmm.
is brand new for the world. There's all kinds of new information and new ideas that are coming out, so people might be extremely surprised about how that apple can play a different role depending on the time that you eat it.
Mm-hmm. And it also has a serious impact on then when you should be exercising and how you should be exercising. It's all related. Like, you can't tease one part out and just say, you know, here's something else. Everything is interrelated and everything is extremely complex. And I think that's why the diet component of this is incredibly, incredibly complex, because it's totally dependent on your circadian rhythms. And if you have if the circadian rhythms are not regulated, if there's a deregulation to them, then when you eat and what you eat is going to have a serious impact on your overall health, because you might be thinking that that is something healthy, but you know, what it's doing to your gut, what it's doing to your pancreas could be something devastating.
Mm-hmm. Well, because it's all interrelated as a system that's both subtle and complex. And thank goodness we have you here to tell us about it, because it's a pretty big topic.
It's huge. Like, as I have gotten into it, like, my initial thing was exercise. Like, I started with exercising, because I thought my diet was pretty good, right? I knew about my diet. We ate well. We ate all kinds of healthy food. Junk food was not a big part of our life. Every once in a while, if we were going camping, you know, we participated in eating some chips and all of that. But it wasn't a big component. You know, it wasn't our everyday thing. Everyday diet was pretty healthy diet in terms of food intake, large bowls of vegetables that I would make for our children when they would come back from school. But what was interesting about this was that I knew that, and I thought, okay, if I'm exercising, I will be also eating well. Because once you start training at that level, you start training at an athletic level, first thing you're going to start paying attention to is your diet.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to max it. You want to get the maximum benefits in terms of your training. And the key component, as any sports nutrition, in terms of any kind of sports nutrition, will let you know that the application of eating strategies to promote good health and the adaptation to training is to recover quickly after each exercise training.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you want to have that kind of diet that helps you recover, that helps you build your muscle mass, that's like, you know, gets you optimal for a competition, right? Mm-hmm. So as soon as, like, I got into exercise, I started looking at diet. But the most of my data that I was looking at in terms of academia was coming from sports nutrition, because it wasn't like shift work, sports nutrition, and athleticism. It was just people who are athletes, who are training, this is what you need to eat. But you forget that those athletes also are expected to have regular circadian rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is when your circadian rhythms are somewhat skewed, that is going to seriously impact. The diet component is going to have a serious impact on your overall metabolic health.
And there's so many things in life that can affect your circadian rhythms. I mean, I think that you have this long expertise that has come from being through several different phases in your life that would have an impact on your rhythms and on your dietary needs. I mean, you have been, you've gone through motherhood and pregnancy, you've been a shift worker, you've been very committed to exercise, and that has changed over the years in what you do and when you do it. And you're also, like the rest of us, getting older and noticing how that affects your body. So I feel like the knowledge that you have is based on such a long and rich and in-depth experience, lived experience, as it were, that it really enriches your ability to interpret and synthesize this very complex topic.
Indeed, and I think that's why when it took me a while to get to this particular topic, because it is so layered and it is so complex. And to tease it apart, you have to go to the very beginning and then kind of unravel it, which is exactly what we're doing.
And speaking of going to the beginning, we didn't talk very long about how you learned when you were growing up and the different influences that you had, but obviously that has a lifelong impact on people. And I just would love to hear a little bit more about how you got knowledge about food and about the world and about how things worked. You mentioned your mom and your grandfather. I'm sure that your father was also an influence. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, my father was amazing in terms of educating us. He was, and still is, the way he taught us was very different from anything else I have ever experienced or seen in other parents. And his was very much an experiential-based learning. So our father was good in teaching us in terms of where the food was coming from. And so in terms of experiences, one of the things that I remember the most was my dad taking us to the mill, which to see the wheat being turned into flour, to see how food, how things were done. Like, he would take us to all these various different places, but that mill going to pick up our flour, which, by the way, came from one of my dad's farms. The wheat came from my dad's farm, and watching it transfer into flour. And then I still to this day remember, Kim, putting my hand in it and the warmth of that flour still has, like, I still remember it so clearly. But I think important part for my dad was to make sure that we have a window into all these different parts of the world. And when we complained about food, for example, which kids do, right? Like, kids go, oh, I don't like that. I don't want to eat that. He was, like, even my mother, they were never the kind of people that would be like, well, if you don't like it, then you're not getting anything. Or if, too bad, this is all we have. Or let me make you something else. Instead, I remember my father, like when we did complain, maybe it was about the zucchini that my mother made, a fourth different variation on it, was actually taking us, my dad took me for a very long walk into the slums, which are a very common part of India. You'll find laborers from other state, migrant laborers coming from other state, working, you know, wherever they had work, they would stay, put up these shanty towns and stay there and then move once the project was done. And we walked through these shanty towns. And my father asked me to observe very closely how people lived when they had so little, and asked me to remember why it's important to be grateful for things that we have. And every actually couple of times a year, we would go, we would have fasting. Like, we would have our, we would get up in the morning and have water, and then we would fast for most of the day. And it wasn't religious. It was more for us to remember what it's like to be hungry. And we knew we were getting food at the end of the day. But my father wanted us to know what it would be like if you went hungry and you didn't know where the food, if you were going to be able to eat, or if you're going to have a meal by the end of the day or the next day. And I think that was it was really important for him to educate us in that way. So we experienced those things, that it was not just words that were being spewed, saying, you know, how we say to our kids, you know, there are so many people going without food. Mm-hmm. And as my child also says, well, you know, that's the experience that I've not had. So it's very difficult for me to understand what that means. Like, I can say, yeah, that's a terrible thing. But my father, actually, we went through this process, because in India, poverty is right in your, like, it's in your face, right? Mm-hmm. It's not hidden. It's not those few panhandlers that are sitting on the streets, you know, or homeless people. It's everywhere. And I think it was really important for him to educate us on that. And I'm actually very grateful for that, because it really made me appreciate everything. And they were very good about not wasting anything. And I think I carry that with me now as well.
That sounds like a really powerful lesson. And I love the idea of him giving you these really enriching experiences where, instead of just reading or hearing about something, you actually got to experience it in a way that was in your own body, because those are things that you never do forget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or the taste of the simplest meal that you get at the end of the day. And that was the amazing part, was the end of the day, we would have the simplest of meals. And that meal was unlike anything you had ever tasted, right?
So a good lesson in subjectivity as well.
Indeed, and appreciation. Mm-hmm. And it was also, and now I think about it, also probably was to give my mother a break from from cooking.
Things you don't pick up on when you're a kid, right?
No, I think those are all retrospective analysis.
But it's very interesting to me, because I often feel like an anthropologist in my own culture. And it has always fascinated me that in my lifetime, it seems normal for North Americans to expect and demand that they are completely insulated from any realities that differ, even in the smallest ways, from their own. So lots of people might have a theoretical understanding about the fact that poverty exists or that people are homeless, but they never actually get a chance to see it or experience it in any real or meaningful way. And I think we have the same attitudes toward food as well. You were talking about going to the mill and seeing it being ground and the fresh flour. What a wonderful experience that is. I know a lot of meat eaters that really would prefer not to know that they're eating the muscle of an animal, and that would never go near a slaughterhouse. They really just, you know, they like the taste, they need the protein, but they'd really rather not know or think about it. And I also remember working with youth and teaching kids how to cook, and it was constantly surprising to me how many kids did not know that whipped cream is whipped cream.
Mm-hmm.
They thought it only came from a can, and I'm like, no, honey, listen to the words. It's whipped cream. And for them, that was a complete revelation. They were delighted to discover this thing that they never knew. And that's pretty simple.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that that's not part of our education system. That mm-hmm. ought to be. I mean, in very select few schools, that is, kids are being shown, like, where the food is coming from, because they have small gardens within the school, and then they cook together. But I don't think that is part of the curriculum, and I think that's where we're failing our kids, because we are educating kids to pass tests, right?
Yes.
But not to live a life that is healthy, that is meaningful. And how do you show what is healthy and what is meaningful? Food is such a huge part of who we are.
Absolutely.
And that's something that is not part of the curriculum, is always shocking to me. So when I am doing workshops and I am talking about sleep, my first thing is always to make sure that I take fresh bread, and there is fresh fruit, and it's local, and the bread is made by a local baker, and that they know the baker by the name, that I introduce it as such, and where the fruit is coming from. And also, when you're going into schools, you're realizing how many of these kids are hungry. And you probably know more about this as well, working with the youth as well, knowing how many of them go hungry, how many of them have no access to breakfast in the morning or lunch. And how can one learn? How can one get educated when you're hungry? It's beyond me.
Yes, it's a huge problem. The impact on the ability to both learn and to regulate your behavior in a kid that is dealing with all kinds of challenges, including hunger, it's not reasonable to expect them to be able to succeed under those conditions.
No, it's not at all. And I think if that's not part and process of education, then we are failing our kids in so many different ways. And, you know, in terms of our where the food is, like, I think this idea of seeing food as just passive consumption is a terrible notion. We should know where our food is coming from. We should know what we're eating, because, you know, we have a relationship. There's a strong relationship between consumption and environment and nature. And if we are not seeing that, how can we be a part of it? How can we make it better?
Yes. Yes, the idea of taking something in with both thoughtfulness and gratitude,
mm-hmm.
instead of just, you know, shoving fried objects into our mouths. They're complete opposites.
Yeah, indeed. And there's, like, you know, I'm so looking forward to going into idea of, like, how the bacteria in our gut influences our anxiety and depression. Like, what we eat actually affects where our mood is at, where how we learn. All of this is so strongly correlated, and there is so much interesting scientific data coming out, and I'm really looking forward to having these conversations with you and you know, deconstructing all of this and doing deep dives.
Oh my gosh, it just sounds so interesting. I expect I'm going to learn a lot. I'm looking forward to it.
I think I'm going to learn a lot. I'm looking forward to it myself. Oh, thank you, Kim, for joining me on this.
Thank you so much. That was delightful.
Our introductory episode to diet, sleep, and shift work. And thank you, everybody, for joining us on this episode of Sleep in Society. I am delighted that Kim Breland is going to be guest hosting this particular segment of Sleep in Society podcast. And I'm so looking forward to our next conversation.
Me too. It's going to be delicious.
And thank you all. We'll connect soon.
Thank you for listening to the Ruhi Sleep, Sleep in Society podcast, available on ruhisleep.ca. Don't forget to follow us on social media @ruhisleep on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thank you for listening.